think it's time we should make a start. Colin's done a very interesting paper for us today, and Colin's quite an interesting actuary. He's worked in banking, superannuation, life insurance and general insurance, and worked on a number of projects really outside the actuarial field. And his biopic says, while he's a qualified actuary, his work experience includes product management, software development and marketing roles. The one that I find quite interesting is developing license plate recognition software for petrol stations with a history of drive-off fuel theft. It sounds quite interesting, and of course the paper's quite novel. The other part of Colin's life that in fact I've known Colin for a long time, and I was unfortunate enough to accept a spot challenge in the pool at a GI seminar last year, and wondered why I couldn't stay with Colin. And I think we did one lap of a 25-metre pool, four different strokes, and there were four actuaries in the pool. And I subsequently found on his biopic that he's a past 200-metre butterfly state champion on the short course. But he reckons in his current shape he couldn't swim 200 centimetres butterfly. Well, let me tell you, don't get fooled. Colin Priest.
I'm glad to see there's some people here. At 1:30, we had no one here. So those of you who turned up expecting to see a general insurance paper, you will either be very disappointed or very happy, depending on whether you like general insurance papers. This is actually a paper that is about economics. It happens to involve a general insurance product, but everything I'm presenting is about economics rather than about a general insurance specific actuarial practice. So basically what the paper's about, and that is that Australians drive greater distances than is socially optimal and or even economically optimal. And the reason they do this is because the cost of driving is not borne entirely by the driver. Society bears, and I've done some estimates later on, about half the cost of driving. Another reason that they do that, even though the driver bears some of those costs, is that the insurance costs are fixed. So the costs are unrelated to how far you drive. So in a marginal cost perspective, insurance costs nothing per trip. So basically then I present pay-as-you-drive, which is a newish form of motor insurance, and how from an economic perspective that improves the situation. So I'm going to begin by defining a term that I use in the paper, and that's called social cost. That's an economic term, not an actuarial term. Basically, social cost is the sum of private cost and external cost. Now, what do I mean by private cost and external cost? I've got cascading definitions happening here. Private cost is what the decision maker has to pay. So the person who decides whether to, in this particular case, it's the person who decides whether to drive or not. It's what they have to pay. And the external cost are all the remaining costs, whether they be monetary or non-monetary. So if we think about that in terms of driving, the private cost is, well, one of the big ones is petrol. There's also insurance. There'll also be some wear and tear. I couldn't find a picture for wear and tear on cars. But there's those sorts of costs that you would expect to see. And then there are a lot of different external costs. There's the cost of building roads so that the cars have got something to drive on. There's the cost of traffic congestion. Every time you drive out on the road, you add to the congestion and you cause inconvenience to other people on the roads. There's some of the cost of traffic accidents. Now, while some of that is covered by insurance, there's a fair bit that isn't. There are excesses and exclusions on CTP. And then there's the flow-on cost. If you're a family member of someone who's injured in a motor vehicle accident, that is a cost. You bear some suffering. There's pollution. That includes greenhouse gases. And there is oil dependency. So the economy becomes too dependent upon oil. Now, if we look at it from a marginal perspective, insurance drops out because basically insurance is charged per annum, not per trip. That means from a marginal perspective, the marginal cost of a trip is actually quite small compared to the social cost of a trip. So if another definition for you, economics beginner lessons here. Sorry, that didn't move. What didn't it do? There we go. Is negative externalities. I've accidentally jumped slides. A negative externality is when the external cost is positive. It means that the social cost is greater than the direct cost or private cost. So now, that's a problem, well known to economists. And what happens when you've got negative externalities is that you end up with overproduction, overuse or overconsumption of a particular item, because the true cost of the decision is not borne by the person making the decision. There's an economic bias happening there. So, you know, as an example of this, I've just finished working at an insurance company, but that insurance company every Wednesday morning had a thing called Health Day, and they would serve food. It was supposedly healthy food, although sometimes there were potato chips and cheese. I don't know how that got in there. But basically, I never had a staff member away on a Wednesday because it was no marginal cost to them for the food. They got very excited about free food. Now, when we apply that to cars, what that means is that we choose to drive more often than is economically efficient because we don't bear in the margin, we don't bear enough of the cost. If we were bearing the full cost of our decision, we would make a different decision. Example of that, I remember, and this is a very long time ago because I'm old, when I got my first ever company car just after I qualified as an actuary. Now, the marginal cost, once I had that company car, of driving was nil. They just took a fixed amount out of my package, as a package each year. So all of a sudden, I started driving everywhere. I was racking up about 40,000 kilometres per annum. Because it didn't cost me a thing. Now, that's a clear negative externality. The person making the decision did not bear the cost, and so it ended up with overuse, overconsumption. So, from an economic perspective, what we try to do is to reduce negative externalities so that we end up with pricing decisions that are more efficient from an economic perspective. And so what you try to do is to transform those external costs into direct costs. So in my paper, I estimate, beginning with just what the total social cost of driving is. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of that in the presentation today. I'd encourage you to read the paper about how I came up with those estimates. And basically, my estimates are coming in around $45 billion per annum in Australia is the cost of driving. There's some conservatism in that in those estimates. There's some things that I haven't included because I didn't know how to estimate them. There's other things that it was a wide range, so I took a sort of lowish estimate just to be safe. But now, regardless of this, we're talking an extremely large amount of money that and cost that relates to driving in Australia each year. Now, I've restricted this purely to private vehicles. This doesn't include trucks or buses. It doesn't include commercial vehicles. Now, as an example of where I've been conservative, for oil dependence, I've allowed for only 1 year of lower GDP growth from oil price increases. Now, if we look at the 1970s and we look at the oil shock back then, the oil shock hit the economy for longer than 1 year. Okay, traditional motor insurance. And I'm just going to show a few slides about how motor insurance is traditionally priced. And basically, we begin typically with rating factors that relate to the driver and the vehicle. And what these are, that we're trying to get proxy measures for differentials in the skills of the driver and the safety of the car. So typically, you'll charge more for an 18-year-old male than you will for a 35-year-old woman. Different skill sets, and so different patterns of driving. You typically charge more, everything else being equal, for an older car than a new one, because the newer cars have ABS and other safety features. Now, as well as looking at the car and the driver, you typically have some rating factors that relate to the location. And what these are, you know, these rating factors are a proxy for the driving environment. And that's things like the road quality, the traffic, the weather. And so that's pretty common. It all makes sense. Then if we then come to how things come together, so we've got the ability of the driver and the safety of the vehicle, we've got the driving environment, then we've got an exposure to risk measure. And that exposure to risk measure in normal forms of motor insurance is time. You typically buy a year's worth of cover. Now, some of these other factors are sometimes used as proxies, and without people realising it, for differentials in distance driven. So, for instance, if you look at some ABS stats, you'll see, for instance, that young people, and I do mean, you know, people under 25, actually drive a shorter distance every year than people in the middle-aged. Retirees drive less than people that are in their working ages. And so when you see some of these other rating factors, I mean, example, the driver age, it's not just about their ability, it's a little bit of a proxy for how far they drive. But this proxy measure is quite imperfect. You can get two individuals, everything else being equal, that drive entirely different distances. One may walk to work and the other may drive to work. Everything else being equal, they have quite different exposures. Now, you should also note that some insurers have distance driven as a rating factor. There's a small number. I'm aware that Shannon's do it. I think Zurich might do it. That is different to pay-as-you-drive insurance. Having something as a rating factor is different to having something as an exposure measure. Now, the best way I can explain that is if you look at workers' compensation. In workers' compensation, wages are an exposure measure, not a rating factor. You don't know the exposure measure up front. You make an estimate, you pay a premium. When you get to know the actual wages for the year, then you do an adjustment premium. So in that sense, it's not just a value you set up front and that was the premium and that's it. It's actually an exposure measure. It changes the premium. But in pay-as-you-drive, we use kilometres as the exposure measure. And there's a couple of different ways that's done in real life. One is that you put a GPS tracking device on the vehicle, and each month you track how far the vehicle drives, and then you charge a premium depending on how far they drove. And that's in place in a number of countries. As far as I know, it's not in Australia, but it's certainly used in the US, in parts of Europe, certainly the UK, South Africa. And the other way that I've seen used, in fact I've been involved in, is where you buy motor vehicle coverage for a range of odometer readings. So you might buy 10,000 kilometres worth of cover, and that may be from an odometer reading of 15,000 to 25,000. You're covered for that range. If your accident happens after you've driven 10,000 kilometres, you're not covered anymore. So you can see that that's not a rating factor, it's an exposure measure. Now, there are extensions out there in real life to pay as you drive. There's also pay how you drive and pay where you drive. I'm certainly aware of pay where you drive operating in South Africa, and I'm also aware of these extensions sometimes have problems. They raise privacy concerns. So when I spoke to a product manager for Pay As You Drive in South Africa, he was telling me that they'd had issues with claims handling because people would say the accident happened in a particular location. They'd go and get the GPS records and discover that the person wasn't in that location at the time they said. And they were getting really worried about that because they thought people were committing fraud. And what it turned out to be was cheating husbands off having an affair and not wanting to admit where they really were. So you can see that there are sometimes you don't want people to know where you were. So there are some privacy concerns relating to pay where you drive, and pay how you drive is an extension which is what times of day you drive, tracking things like what speed you drive, whether you break the speed limit. So jumping back to pay as you drive, you'd expect this to impact on people's behaviour. That's the whole point of what we were talking about. When you bring the marginal costs on the decision maker, it should affect their decision making. And what you expect to see is fewer trips and people combining trips and people substituting other forms of transport. Now, we know that this sort of thing will happen. Last year, when petrol prices skyrocketed, there were record numbers of people using trains in both Sydney and Melbourne. There were reports in the newspapers about that. And if you look at the amount of petrol purchased during that time, it dropped, which is also a proxy for how far people were driving. So people do change their decision making in Australia depending on what the marginal cost of driving is. So what I've done is I've estimated the price elasticity of switching insurance to being per kilometre, so being a marginal cost rather than a fixed cost. And I've related it to the price elasticity of petrol. One, because petrol is one of the major marginal costs of driving. The other is because I know the price elasticity of petrol. There are very good records in existence of price histories for petrol and of purchase histories for petrol. And I didn't even have to do the analysis. There's a government department that even worked out the price elasticity for me. And they've worked out that for every 10% increase in petrol price, there's a short-term reduction in car fuel use of about 1.5%. Now, I note the caveat of short-term. The long-term is actually more than that. In the short-term, people just reduce how far they drive. In the long-term, petrol use drops about 4% because people switch to more fuel-efficient vehicles. But they don't do that in the short-term. They do that in the long-term. I've only used the short-term number because I'm interested in usage of vehicles, not which vehicles that people switch to. So basically I've done that and I've worked out, basically you total up the petrol with the insurance cost and you say what's the cost of petrol plus insurance versus just the cost of petrol. That gives you a percentage increase in the marginal cost of driving. And that brings out that we should get a change in kilometres driven of about reduction of about 7%. Now we can compare that to some overseas experience. The first two examples there are actual trials where some people were put onto pay-as-you-drive products in the US and they measured how far they drove before they were on that product and how far they drove after they were on that product. The third line there is a paper that inspired this paper. It's some economists over in the US, and they did a forecast of what pay-as-you-drive style insurance would do to driving habits in the USA. And they estimated a reduction of about 8%. So this table looks a bit like one I showed you earlier, but basically it's basically a pro rata of what we saw before. If we had a total cost of about $45 billion and we're going to reduce the usage by 7%, then every year we're going to save more than $3 billion in Australia. So you see the biggest sort of savings is petrol, which is a direct cost, but then there's a number of other savings that flow to society. So then I'm going to move on now and talk about not just about insurance, but what can the government do to help. So I've been talking about how better insurance design can help Australians. Now I'm going to talk about what changes to government policy could also do to help Australians in a similar way. Firstly, I'd like the government to remove unnecessary barriers to pay-as-you-drive. And at the moment, you cannot sell CTP in a pay-as-you-drive form. The CTP scheme rules all around Australia do not let you do that. There are also CTP schemes run by governments, and it would be good if they could switch to this style of insurance. And then the second is to give insurers access to information on vehicle use. Governments have amazingly detailed information on how vehicles are used. One of the hurdles that an insurer has in setting up this type of insurance is a lack of knowledge about driving habits. If insurers can be more certain about what is going on, then they can price with greater certainty, and the product is a lot easier to get out there into the real world. The next thing I'd like governments to do is to actively support pay-as-you-drive. Now, there are upfront costs to insurers of setting up pay-as-you-drive. It's quite difficult to set it up in a computer system. If you're using a GPS tracking style of approach, then there's an upfront cost for that tracking device. So basically, what would be good is if governments, just for the short term, not for the long term, help insurers to get this up and running. And they could do that by waiving government charges, and they could do that by giving rebates to insurers for setup costs. And the final type of thing that would be good for governments to do is to remove their own negative externalities. Registration fees are a fixed cost per annum. They're unaffected by how far you drive, just like insurance. The marginal cost of your rego for each trip is zero. It would be good if the government started charging rego fees that related to how far you drove each year. The other negative externality that I'm aware of is fringe benefit tax. And the fringe benefit tax actually reduces when you drive further distances. So it actually gives an incentive for higher social cost, which is not a good thing. So, coming to our conclusions, Australians drive too much because the costs of driving are not paid directly by the driver or owner, and because some of those costs are fixed and not marginal costs. Pay-as-you-drive can help reduce this economic bias, and I've estimated that it would reduce the distance driven by about 7% compared to current. That reduction of 7% would cause savings in social cost of more than $3 billion per annum. And governments can help. They can remove unnecessary barriers. They can support the introduction of pay-as-you-drive, and they can remove their own negative externalities. So just to finish, I'd just like to thank a couple of people. There's a behavioural economist who helped me out. His name's Richard Tooth, and he gave me some quite helpful suggestions and even corrected a mistake I made in one place. And I'd also like to thank Alan Greenfield for his peer review.
Right, time for some questions. I think Colin's done a great job presenting to us, and I think a very, very interesting paper as well. And he's done us proud by giving us a fair bit of time for discussion. So if you could just come up to the mic, say your name and ask your question. Well, while the audience is thinking about a question, Colin, I'd like to ask you, how do you actually see pay-as-you-go operating in practice in Australia? Which
it already exists in private motor. Sorry, I'll get back up to the lectern.
Pay-as-you-drive already exists. There's a company called Real Insurance that sells a version of it which where you get covered for an odometer range. I used to work there, which is why I have a connection with pay-as-you-drive. So basically, you buy an odometer range. You say what odometer reading you want to start at and what odometer reading you want to end at, and they rely on that for the cover. So if you have a crash, the assessor looks at the vehicle and he looks at the odometer reading and checks whether you're actually in the odometer range. There is the possibility for fraud there, but on the other hand, it is actually a criminal offence to alter your odometer, and they do check for things like that. And so at claim time, they're also checking because odometers are tamper-proof. So if you tamper with an odometer, you actually break a seal on it, and you can check for that at claim time. So that's been in operation since the product launch was late July last year. There's about 10,000 vehicles or so on that at the last time I looked.
Yeah. Can you comment on what sort of pricing discounts drivers took to the insurance?
On average, they've been getting about a quarter of the premium off. That's just on their estimates of how far they'll drive, because you're buying a reading. So it's based on a guess that they're buying a year's worth of cover. They may not be. Certainly anecdotally, I know that some are just buying the minimum amount of cover you have to buy in terms of odometer reading, and some thought it was a really good product and bought a few years' worth of cover because they thought, well, I'll buy this while it's cheap. So I'm not quite sure, but certainly if I just compared the premium they were paying up front to what they would have paid on a traditional motor policy, it was around 25 to 30% saving.
You mentioned buying a number of years cover, so how does this policy actually work? If you're buying an odometer reading, does that mean...
This is just my guess that it was a few years. Partly anecdotal. But the way that particular policy works is actually broken up into two parts. There's a time-based cover and there's a kilometre-based cover. And now when we're talking about private motor, that's quite different to CTP. In CTP, if you do not drive your car at all, it is impossible for you to have a claim. In private motor, that's not the case. Your car can be stolen, it can be vandalised, it can catch fire, something can fall on it. There's a number of things that, you know, hail can get it. There's a number of things in private motor that are unrelated to the kilometres you drive. And so the way that the Real Insurance's product works is that you pay a certain annual premium and then you buy a kilometre range for the rest.
Yes, please, just... Charles Hett, I'm not very familiar, I come from New Zealand, I'm not very familiar with the Australian system, but in New Zealand we've seen petrol companies getting closer to supermarkets. It may well be happening here, and it occurred to me that maybe there's an opportunity for insurers to get closer to petrol companies and simply charge the premiums by doing a deal, you know, with petrol companies and effectively getting the premium directly linked to the price of petrol.
Did you just come up with that?
Yes.
Ah, it's been thought of before. That's right.
Yes.
It was proposed in the US about 10 years ago that you buy your insurance cover as part of buying your petrol. Because petrol is a relatively good proxy for how far you're driving. It's never taken off. I think more because of the admin than anything else. Who gets that insurance money? People, when they buy petrol, typically want to be in and out relatively quickly. So I have another business you missed earlier, the intro, that's related to service stations. And we're putting license plate recognition into service stations to catch people with a history of drive or fuel theft. So I have a little bit of knowledge about patterns there. And the reason that exists, rather than people post-pay petrol, because that's the way people think in petrol stations. And service stations let them do that because then they impulse buy something else. If they're forced to do anything other than fill up petrol, queue up and just maybe grab something, they don't like that. They don't like complexity. And the reason you don't get lots of prepay in Australia on petrol is because people don't like the complexity of estimating how much petrol they're going to need before they put it in the car.
You had indicated that there's probably a bias in the type of person who buys the pay-as-you-drive. My guess would be the people who drive fewer miles are more likely to want it.
That would be the case in the savings estimates that I told you before, about that 25 to 30%. Because you've got a choice between two products, quite clearly you're going to get people choosing whichever one's cheaper for them. About two-thirds of people drive less than the average kilometres for their peers. It's a very skewed distribution. So most people save if they go to pay-as-you-drive.
If an insurance company were to offer this product, would they then have to refigure the rates for the people who don't do the pay-as-you-drive to properly capture the
fact? I raised that when I was with my previous employer. the problem of negative selection, in the short term, they were dealing with that by going with totally different brand names for selling the two things and not the one sales process. You can't just pick and choose directly, but there will be some of that happening. Ultimately, what will happen if this takes off is that it will chomp into the normal private motor, and the stuff that's left will get worse and worse relative to the average, and that'll gradually force its price up, which will force more people over to pay as you drive. Just a classic actuarial problem there. As if you've got a major rating factor you're not including and someone starts to include it, eventually everyone has to include it. And so those savings that I was talking about $3 billion per annum, that's by putting everyone onto pay-as-you-drive. So making all forms of motor insurance pay-as-you-drive.
The thought occurs to me that there'd be quite a big difference between domestic and commercial motor vehicle insurance.
I've stuck to private motor vehicle here.
Yep.
One of the reasons I've done that is because a fair bit of commercial is fleet at the moment, and that's already experience rated, so it's already got quite good proxy for that exposure. But you could apply it to individual commercial vehicles in the same way. No one that I know has done that yet. The other reason you probably wouldn't do it is because commercial vehicle use probably doesn't have the same price elasticity as personal vehicle use. A lot of it is less of a voluntary choice. You still have to go and deliver the vehicles, or the plumber still has to drive out to the site to repair the pipes.
Some more questions from the floor? I think it is really quite a fascinating topic, and I guess, Colin, I was wondering whether the price differential really was enough to change people's behaviours. But I think, following on from the previous question, if in actual fact people start moving to pay-as-you-drive and the rates for people who don't start going up, that might be a big enough change in price for behavioural change to occur.
Yeah, behavioural change also depends on how you structure your pay-as-you-drive product. So that real insurance one, you don't get feedback on it. The GPS-related ones, you get monthly bills typically. And the more frequent the feedback that you get on the cost of your vehicle usage, the greater the impact upon your behaviour. So in many ways, the optimal way of doing this is to have a GPS tracking system. I think you'll find that maybe with the GFC, I finally got that in. I found a way of bringing it into the presentation. That people like me who just lost their jobs probably won't be driving as much. That's quite a bit of a differential for me. But also people become a bit more price sensitive during those times. And certainly, as I said last year, when the petrol prices went up, people started driving a lot less. And they would, when they start to make that decision, it makes them think about their other decisions relating to driving. And I think when we get out of the GFC, and the petrol price starts going up again, because it's what I consider a level that's way below what it should be, people will start thinking again about the marginal cost of their driving and about their driving decisions. But things like CTP, I think you should switch an entire scheme over to it or not. You shouldn't make it an optional thing. And CTP is where you get the biggest improvement, because as I said, you can't make a CTP claim if you never drive your car.
I've actually, for quite some time now, been aware of the dichotomy between, I guess, the current federal government's views about the environmental impacts of things like driving and the FBT situation. Is that something you think that's just not on their radar, or is it just too unpopular to contemplate changing it?
I really don't know. I have to admit, I put it in there because Alan Greenfield suggested it to me. I wasn't even aware of it.
Well, I've got a vehicle that operates under that particular system, and if I don't drive 15k a year, I actually got to pay 26% on the FBD cost of the vehicle, which is the gross, and if I hit that, it goes down to, I think, 18 or 19, but if I go over 40,000k, it comes all the way down to about 10%. So
It's a really bad incentive. I could see someone getting hold of it at some point of time. It's a good thing to lobby the government on, because it's so clearly motivating people to make the absolute wrong decision. And I understand why they put it in the first place, because they're trying to use it as a proxy for private use vehicles that are being called commercial, yep, just to dodge tax. But it's the wrong. It causes the wrong incentives. Anyone ever read the book Freakonomics? It's a bestseller, and the whole book is about wrong incentives that, even if they were well intentioned, cause wrong decisions.
I just got these visions of someone said to me during February and March, because I think our dominant readings for that FBT scale get taken at the 31st of March, people driving around aimlessly during the month of February and managed to get their odometers up. And as we learned from you earlier, it's illegal to fiddle with your odometers. So.
Yep. Yeah, I haven't heard anyone winding their odometers forward.
Well, I've heard of people driving up and down the freeway just to make sure they get over the 15,000.
Yeah, well, if you're just under, it would be worth it. Yeah, just do that extra trip. Yeah. Ah, you've thought this through.
Yeah, I actually had those offers before. People like to go away for the weekends. Or I'll use your car if you don't mind. Yeah. Get some kilometres up for you. Oh, there's one more thing I want to get you to talk about. I think that's probably our 5 minute bill? It looks like time-wise it's getting... Yeah, we'll call it 5 minute. But we'd like to encourage anyone else from the floor to any other questions. The bit that I'd want you... please go.
Sorry, Jeff King. To what extent is the excise that's on petrol a proxy for sort of pay as you drive?
Could you explain the question?
So, I mean, petrol would cost, I don't know how much it would cost.
38 point something cents excise.
Is that right?
I've allowed for that in my social cost because it's actually not part of the social cost. It's a benefit to driving because that goes into the public coffers, and if we had a decent government, would go into useful things. So in that sense, I've allowed for it in my paper. I'm not sure what you mean by as a proxy for pay as you drive.
Well, the more you drive, the more you pay the excise.
Oh, that sort of relates to the concept we were talking about before, is maybe you could charge your insurance as part of the petrol cost. Maybe that's what we're talking about.
Or is it already built in that sense, 38 cents a kilometre?
It partly exists to reduce the negative externalities. Mm. So in theory, that money goes towards building roads. If you look at the numbers, there's far more coming in than goes into building roads.
I guess it's a good point, because if in fact it seems like the price barriers are a great disincentive to drive. So if that tax was doubled, which would be politically not all that popular, I wouldn't imagine.
You will see other negative externalities disappear in the near future. So when they bring in carbon pricing, that will flow into the petrol price. And so that'll be another reduction in negative externalities.